To those who claim we can't afford to protect the environment and the economy at the same time, Amy Larkin says,
I say in the book, no nature, no business. It's that simple. No water, no business. No sustainable agriculture, no commodities. It's not rocket science. It's basic.
We talk with Larkin about her terrific new book, Environmental Debt, The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy. And a new novel for kids of all ages speaks to us in the poignant voice of a gorilla. It's based on the true story of Ivan the Gorilla, captive for 30 years in the suburban mall.
I had never written first-person gorilla before, so it was a bit of a challenge. And I had done a lot of research about animals and played around with the idea of being inside an animal's POV. But for Ivan, I had to really think about what it would be like to be captive.
That's Catherine Applegate. She tells us about the one and only Ivan later on in the show. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It's 43 years since the first Earth Day was celebrated April 22nd in 1970. And the news ain't good. 2012 was the hottest year on record. Half of all species are on target for going extinct. Clean water, air, and soil is getting scarcer. Everywhere we look, the natural systems we depend on are falling apart. Yet conventional political wisdom says we can't do anything about it because it will be too costly for business, government, and jobs. Our entire economy is based on cheap, easy, and convenient. But how cheap is it really? Take coal, the cheapest and most polluting of the fossil fuels. A recent study showed if the price of coal was set to include its environmental and health costs, it would easily double. In other words, the coal companies are racking up an environmental debt equal to their revenues. Only they aren't on the hook for the debt. We are. My guest Amy Larkin's terrific new book, Environmental Debt, lays out the case for tackling that debt now. In effect, she says, we need to start paying more for pollution so that we can pay less in the hidden costs now and in the future. And the book explodes the myth of the contradiction between environmental protection and business. We can have it all, she says, a prosperous economy and a clean environment. She calls it the nature means business model. But the corollary is also true. No nature, no business. Amy Larkin is a long-term environmental activist who was on the board of Greenpeace and served as director of Greenpeace Solutions, bringing activists and business together to solve environmental problems. She blogs at Huffington Post. Amy Larkin, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
You are an environmental activist, and you were on the board of Greenpeace for many years. Often environmental activists and corporations have been on the opposite sides of the fence of issues, environmental issues. They've been antagonists. But in this book, Environmental Debt, you say that business can play an important transformational role. In fact, one that's even swifter than government. What convinced you of this?
I volunteered for Greenpeace for 25 years, and then I worked as solutions director for about 6.5. And in that time, my thinking really evolved. As solutions director of Greenpeace, I worked actively with many large multinational corporations. And I discovered that within these corporations, there are fierce environmentalists who want to do the right thing, and in their minds, the right thing. So not only in the mind of an active environmentalist, but it's good for business. If you protect your sourcing materials so they are long-term viable, given climate change issues, given regulation issues, given price issues, you're in better shape. The only way to do that is to engage in sustainable sourcing. There is no other way.
For those in our audience who are not in of a business background, explain what you mean by sustainable sourcing.
Well, you can be needing fish for your product. And if you either fish all the fish or you destroy the ocean, you have no more fish. So the way to keep your source of fish ongoing is to do your sourcing of your primary product in a way where the fish get to survive. Mm-hmm. And as the fish survive, your company survives, not to mention the planet.
So you're basically saying the idea that there's some contradiction between business and environmental safety is a wrong one.
I say in the book, no nature, no business. It's that simple. No water, no business. No sustainable agriculture, no commodities. It's not rocket science. It's basic. You know, we are living in a world of constrained resources. We all know that. We can feel it. And you don't have to be an environmental activist to feel that.
You know, I want to just ask you before we go on, what does the Solutions Director of Greenpeace do?
Our mission was to work with corporations, sometimes target corporations, for transformational change. So one of the biggest pieces of work we did was work with large multinationals, starting with Coke, Pepsi, Unilever, finally moving on to the Consumer Goods Forum, which is 400 of the largest retailers and consumer brands to eliminate HFCs. HFCs are the worst greenhouse gases you never heard of. They are the major chemical used in refrigeration. And for most of the companies in the retail sector, these chemicals are number one, number two, or number three piece of their carbon footprint. So when Walmart first measured its carbon footprint, I don't know, 8 years ago or so, to their utter shock, refrigeration was number two. The first item was the electricity used to generate their stores. The second was refrigeration. And the third was their trucking fleet, which is the largest trucking fleet in the world. So that's how intense and powerful and high impact these chemicals are. So as Greenpeace Solutions Director, we successfully worked with the Consumer Goods Forum to advocate for and help them pass a resolution that the industry would eliminate HFCs from their refrigeration by 2015.
Are they on target to do that?
They are. Some of them are on target, some of them are not. And actually, I'm working with them now again from outside of Greenpeace to try to help implement and accelerate the resolution. But in fact, since this resolution in 2010, there is a huge amount of new scientific literature emphasizing the importance of eliminating HFCs. There is a new global group of governments, actually led by the U.S. government and Canada and Mexico and the EU, to, I think it's 50 nations now. They have a list of six short-term acting greenhouse gases that they believe can have the largest fast impact on averting catastrophic climate change. Mm-hmm. So the whole landscape has changed, and the EU is negotiating regulations right now for a vote in the fall.
Wow, that's terrific. So environmental debt. We hear a lot about financial debt, but we don't hear a whole lot about environmental debt. Tell us what that is.
Well, first of all, you don't hear a lot about it yet. Hopefully that will change. Environmental debt is the real cost of the things we use. So all of us know that there are more kids with asthma, more kids with the developmental disabilities, more hospital expenses for this, more people who have to stay home from work, fisheries where weird things are happening or fisheries disappearing. We all know this. Hurricane Sandy, that's a $100 billion event caused by climate change factors. Who's paying? You and I are paying. We are paying as taxpayers. So $50 billion here, $20 billion here, $5 billion there. If you are an insurance company, you are paying. If you are a family, you are paying. All of these costs are actually environmental debt. They are not counted as the price you pay for the things you buy, but they are the costs of the things you buy. That is what environmental debt is.
You also make the point, Amy Larkin, in your book, Environmental Debt, the hidden costs of a changing global economy. You make the point that this debt is something that we are paying now for decisions that were made in the past. And give some examples, because even though the concept makes sense, I was shocked by some of the examples that you gave.
Well, one of the examples that's in the book is Thailand. Most of us remember the Thai floods of 2011, which were horrible. They basically shut the country down and caused great fatality and harm to the people of Thailand and the government of Thailand. And they were caused by a very intense storm, which may or may not have been because of climate change. But it went from a terrible storm situation to a catastrophe because of deforestation. Thailand had been largely deforested, and largely through the 80s and 90s, and the soil could not hold the water. So what would have been certainly bad flooding became catastrophic because the mountainsides had fallen down. There was no topsoil to hold all the water. So that impact from 20 and 30 years ago caused Toyota and Honda to close factories for months. Tens of thousands of workers lost jobs in the Philippines, Kentucky, and Singapore. I believe it was 2.5%, maybe even more, of Toyota's annual output because the factories that made the widgets for their cars were in Thailand, and they were closed, and there was no transportation and no more widgets. So this is a case where whatever the companies that bought those trees 25 years ago paid, they did not pay for the catastrophe 25 years later. That is the cost of deforestation, one of the costs of deforestation. That is environmental debt. And a lot of people paid, a lot of governments paid, families paid, companies paid, governments paid. It is across the spectrum. And until we align the price we pay for something with the cost of the actual product, good, or service, we will not have an economy that functions well enough.
Now, in this book, you talk about, as you said before, no nature, no business framework.
I believe that there are three guiding principles for 21st century commerce, and I call it the nature means business framework. The first one is pollution can no longer be free nor subsidized. The second one is the long term must guide all decision making and accounting. And the third one is government has to reclaim its role as vitalizing and catalyzing the next iteration of technology and also penalize corporations that destroy the future.
So let's take these in turn because I found them very interesting. And I want to say also to our listeners, this book was a terrific read, and these concepts were just really explained in a way that was tremendously engaging and pithy. So let's take the first. I think we've covered a little bit of it, but maybe there's some things we haven't talked about in terms of subsidizing business that incurs environmental debt. There's kind of an opportunity cost here. It means that we're not subsidizing and not helping business that will pay down that debt.
So in 2012, the United States federal deficit was $1.1 trillion. And that was the trigger for the sequester. In 2007 and 2009, the combined external costs, the environmental debt for coal and oil just in the United States was $1.2 trillion, more than the federal deficit. That $1.2 trillion was costs for water, labor, land, railroads, destroyed ecosystems, health costs, educational costs, unemployment, other businesses being harmed. Those costs were paid across the spectrum. A lot by governments, the federal government, the state governments, local governments, a lot by families, and a lot by other businesses.
And you're just talking about costs in that year. You're not even talking about the future costs, which I'm sure the interest is going to be pretty high.
The basic fundamental change on how we view what we pay for has to be figured by incorporating the cost of pollution.
So we're debating in this country now the permission to build the XL Keystone Pipeline from Canada down to the southern United States. I'd like to get some of your thoughts on this within this context of environmental debt and also within the context of subsidizing the fossil fuel industries. Is it at the expense of other industries? I mean, there are those who say that this is going to provide a lot of jobs, so that it balances out.
I am all for the government training people for great jobs. But if you provide jobs that are short-term jobs, you are making bad investments. So when you make energy investments, they are usually 30 to 50-year investments. So if you invest in an infrastructure that looks like it is not going to be viable within 10 years, it's a bad investment. When you make an investment in someone's education, job retraining, high-speed internet infrastructure, rail infrastructure, interstate highways, when you make those kinds of investments, you have returns for decades. In every way, they provide benefits for business, for society, for the people that live here. They're good investments. When you make an investment for something that continues to contribute to climate change, dirty rivers, dirty waters, very dangerous environmental crises, you're making a bad investment. So am I concerned that you would destroy, for example, the coal economy? Yes, I think that's a real thing to be concerned about. I don't wish any workers ill. I want to retrain them so that they, instead of mining coal, how about if they weatherize every building in the United States? That would have benefits in every way. And how about they learn to do solar installations or geothermal installations? That's such a better investment. The reason why I wrote this book is my frustration that we have not connected the financial crisis with the environmental crisis. We have to look at the money we spend for its long-term impact, its real consequences, and its real costs. When you spend money on something that is not good for you, let's say you spend money on gambling and you have a problem with it as opposed to once a year. When you spend that money, and if it is your mortgage, it's contributing to the GDP, but it's a bad investment. It's a bad thing to do.
And it's going to worsen your debt.
So if you spend money on subsidizing agriculture that destroys waterways, is unsustainable on every level from the environmental to the ethical to the financial. So today you may be making more money, and then tomorrow you're out of luck. And honestly, as a taxpayer, I do not want to pay for that.
We're talking with Amy Larkin about her book, Environmental Debt, The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy. Now, the second part of the framework here is around accounting. You have a very interesting story about Puma Corporation and PricewaterhouseCoopers with the accounting firm. I wonder if you could tell us that story.
Puma was the first multinational corporation to create an environmental profit and loss statement. That is a complete change for current profit and loss statements, because in the current profit and loss statements, you do not account for the consequences of your actions. So Puma, with Pricewaterhouse and Trucost, set upon trying to see if they can actually quantify the costs of their environmental actions. And they went four tiers down on the supply chain, which was incredibly difficult, and that alone took 9 months.
You mean they went all the way back to kind of the very first suppliers?
To the suppliers that sell to them, and the suppliers that sell to the suppliers, and the suppliers that sell to the suppliers that sell to it. They went four tiers down. And they discovered that if they were to pay the real costs of their environmental debt, it would take up about 75% of their profit. And it was a very imperfect study. It was the first try at it. They're doing a new one now with lessons learned. But their parent company, PPR, which owns Puma, Stella McCartney, Yves Saint Laurent, a luxury goods company, is now doing an environmental profit and loss.
So does this mean then that the price of goods like, you know, the clothing that people depend on would really skyrocket? I mean, how do you balance out the immediate budgets of Americans that are getting more and more pinched every day with the environmental debt that we're paying over time?
Well, I would say with great difficulty, first of all. Anybody who says, oh, it's going to be an easy transition to a sustainable green economy, it's not true. It will be difficult. Our entire economy is based on cheap, easy, and convenient. And, you know, I'd love to read a quote from Theodore Roosevelt. In the book, I have a quote from Theodore Roosevelt. The things that will destroy America are prosperity at any price, peace at any price, safety first instead of duty first, the love of soft living, and the get-rich-quick theory of life. So that's from a former American president, and I think it's very relevant to our economy now.
But that's all well and good for people who have a bit of a financial cushion. Do you consider any ways in which there can be, just as we subsidize or may need to subsidize green companies, to help Americans, poorer Americans, make this transition so that you don't have the same kind of political price to pay that makes them so difficult to do?
Absolutely. And that is why the third tenet of my Nature Means Business framework is, in fact, that government must reclaim its role to catalyze and vitalize the good stuff, businesses and the investments they want to make, and at the same time, penalize products, companies, actions that will destroy and cost us more money. So that is why we have to connect financial debt and environmental debt. So if in fact you have cleaner agriculture, you have cleaner water, you have less illness. Imagine if in the transition there is tax incentives, accelerated depreciation, a variety of government-sponsored incentives for businesses that want to use state-of-the-art, sustainable products, sourcing, manufacturing, agriculture. In the book, actually, I have a story about a PepsiCo plant where PepsiCo owns Frito-Lay, and they built a factory in Arizona that was absolutely state-of-the-art. They cracked numerous engineering codes to make it near net zero water, energy, and carbon. And the lead engineer of the project was explaining it to me and very proudly, and it was fantastic. And I said, so I presume you're deploying all of these in your factories globally. And he said, it is more money to do this up front. And so where we can, we are deploying it. And I, of course, went a little ballistic. What do you mean? You cracked the code. How could you not deploy this everywhere? That is what's needed. And he said, I absolutely agree. And when water costs what it should cost, when energy costs what it should cost, when carbon costs what it should cost, and when waste was the other big issue. This is where government steps in. Would you rather pay for the best recycling and composting programs so that our waste is minimized? Or would you rather pay for landfill? Well, landfill is running out. Landfill leaches. Landfill is a horrible solution to our garbage. This is where government has to choose. You can either help the businesses make this transition, help customers who are struggling. Until you connect them, you cannot make that decision. Connect them. It's a very easy decision.
You're putting me in mind of the great environmentalist and labor leader, Tony Mazzocchi, who way back in the 1970s and 80s, he was one of the people who wrote the draft legislation that became the OSHA Act and the EPA. And he talked about a superfund for workers because he was the legislative director of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union. You know, the big trifecta there of the kinds of energy we want to get away from. And he was saying, you know, you can't take it out of the hides of workers. You have to have a super fund that will help employ workers, as you said before, in industries that make them feel good and provide them with a living as well as the rest of us.
When I was working for Greenpeace Solutions and we began working on this study on the true cost of oil with Harvard, I was determined to find the real cost of the transition plan for coal workers. Because I think whether you be a customer or a worker, if we do not connect our real budgets with the real people who are going to suffer, and there will be real suffering, but this is where government can make it much easier. And I asked everywhere, so what is the cost of transition plan for workers, for towns, areas that will go into bus cycles? And a friend of mine who works in the Interior Department said there's really pressure not to make that kind of study.
Why?
Because then you would actually have a path beginning to move workers into the next iteration of technology, and the companies, and not only the companies, the local areas where they are embedded don't want to see the path. But also in my book, there is a study by an economic development agency in Kentucky that shows that in Kentucky, where coal is obviously king, the state has a $115 million loss every year for the cost of coal. That's if you connect the real costs of the coal. And that's by a local Kentucky economic development, not environmental, economic development agency. This is why environmental debt must be included in the computations. Then let's see what our budgets are. Then let's see what our financial debt is. And then let's see what our viable energy sources and industries for the rest of the 21st century. Business as usual is not working, not financially and not environmentally.
So finally, we started talking about transitions. What are some of the other suggestions that you make in your book, Environmental Debt? Amy Larkin.
Well, there's a few ideas that I list, and I'm sure there are many others. An example is biomimicry. And I have to confess, I'm the chair of the Biomimicry Advisory Board in New York City. But biomimicry is the study of nature and the view of nature as something of which we are part. And in nature, they have had to do everything we have to do, from making hard surfaces to gluing things down to surviving in typhoons to creating all kinds of materials to keeping materials dry in the course of a downstorm to staying warm. It's all been done in nature. So imagine if the R&D of the world's industry first asked nature before going into Ask the Chemical Book. And there is a growth of this kind of R&D, but it is not in any way business as usual yet. And I hope it becomes so. Another example is patent pooling. There have been moments throughout history over the last 100 years in the United States and Japan and in other places where a variety of corporations working on the same products share technology to bring a product forward. I believe there are 11 companies that share the patent for the DVD. And I put this idea in here because at varying points when I read about climate change, and then in the next article I read about IBM doing this and GE doing that with the best scientists in the world, with billions of dollars of research, working on renewable energy solutions for transmission or storage, the two big stumbling blocks for a greater uptake. And I always scream at the newspaper or the radio, wherever I'm receiving this information, work together. That doesn't mean you don't get rewarded for your investment. There are patent pooling frameworks where you can safeguard the billion-dollar investments these companies have made. But we're in an emergency. There is a wartime-level emergency for climate change, for making choices every time we make a choice on what to invest in for our energy future. It is a decades-long choice. John Hofmeister, the former president of Shell Oil, in his really good book, Why We Hate the Oil Companies, he says There is political time and there is energy time. Energy is decades long. Political time is as long as it takes to start fundraising after the last election. You cannot make those decisions together. And so connecting the real costs seems to me the only way to start making those decisions wisely.
Amy Larkin, your excellent book, I highly recommend it to all our listeners, is Environmental Debt, The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
Amy Larkin was on the board of Greenpeace and served as director of Greenpeace Solutions. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to some of her recent pieces on Huffington Post. Next up, the one and only Ivan. Stay tuned after the break.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Isn't how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As I mentioned earlier, half of all species on the planet face extinction. Among them, our close relative, the magnificent lowland gorilla. But my guest, Catherine Applegate, has chosen to write her latest novel not about gorillas in the wild, but about one particular gorilla who lives behind bars in a suburban mall. The one and only Ivan is told from the point of view of the title character, with his often poignant, funny, and wise observations about gorillahood, humanity, art, and the love between different species, including humans and other animals. Applegate's book is based on a real Ivan the gorilla, who was taken from the wild in Africa and brought to a strip mall in Tacoma, Washington, where he lived alone in a cage for 30 years until he was moved to a modern zoo. Fiction becomes, in Applegate's hands, a means of exploring our relationship to animals and the impact we have on the animal world. And although The One and Only Ivan is nominally written for children, it's a deeply affecting book that can be read for pleasure by all ages. Catherine Applegate is the author of numerous books for children and young adults, including the award-winning Home of the Brave. Catherine Applegate, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
The One and Only Ivan, I just loved this book on so many levels. And I have to say, I know this is a book for children. And in fact, I began reading it with my 8-year-old granddaughter yesterday, and she also loved it. But I found it a very profound book. It works for adults just as well, wouldn't you say?
Oh, I'm almost delighted to hear that. It's interesting because I envisioned it as, you know, what we would typically call a middle grade novel, meaning maybe 8 to 12 years old. But I have talked to first grade teachers who have used it as a read aloud, despite, you know, some moments that are pretty sad, and high school groups that have read it, and more I'm talking to adult book groups who are using it. So that's really a thrill, because I think the subject matter, and perhaps the way the subject matter is delivered in that it's close to free verse almost, makes it more accessible to a wider age group.
Yes, and it really works on many levels. It's a very poignant book. I found it both profound and poignant, a real kind of exploration of how we humans, the impact that we have on the world and on the creatures that share this planet with us, from their point of view. This is a book about a real gorilla. First, tell us a little bit about the real Ivan before we talk about your character, Ivan.
You know, I came across the real Ivan story maybe 20 years ago in a New York Times article, and the headline read something to the effect of, Gorilla sulks in mall while his future is debated. And it was such a strange and compelling and tragic story that I continued to follow it. I cut it out. You know, this was back in the days when news actually came on newspaper, and I had a big box of ideas, and it seemed like it would make an interesting story. And the real Ivan had been imported, as it were, from Africa and kept in a small sort of strip mall in Tacoma, Washington. And he lived there alone for 27 years before there was a public outcry as people became more aware about the ways we should treat animals in captivity. And he was sort of a local celebrity, and people were horrified at his treatment, but it took a long time and a lot of litigation before he finally made his way to Zoo Atlanta, where he lived out the rest of his years. He just died in August at the age of 50, which in gorilla years is quite geriatric.
And so you came to this story, and you decided to tell it from the point of view of the gorilla. Tell us a little bit about the character as you developed him in his point of view.
You know, I had never written first-person gorilla before, so it was a bit of a challenge. I had done a series with my husband, Michael Grant, called Animorphs, and it was about children who were able to turn into animals, had a sci-fi element. There were 60-plus books in the series. We wrote about 40 of them together. And so I had done a lot of research about animals and played around with the idea of being inside an animal's POV, but for Ivan, I had to really think about what it would be like to be captive. And of course, whenever you do an animal fantasy, there's an element of anthropomorphism, you know, by definition, because, you know, we're speculating. So I wanted to keep it as close to what I thought that perspective might be. And one of the results was I kept it, the prose, very sparse. Not a lot of words. I decided a gorilla would be a primate of few words, and that's how I started. I did try it in many different forms. I wrote it in third person. Had there been an eighth person, I'm sure I would have tried it before I finally arrived at what I thought was the right voice.
And it's a voice, maybe a few words, but many of them are, in fact, quite poetic. In fact, Ivan describes himself as dreamer. Well, he describes gorillas and includes himself, of course, in this. Dreamers, poets, philosophers, and nap takers.
I may have been bringing my personal preferences in at the end there. I'm a consummate nap taker. So
that's just wonderful. Was it difficult to find, to strike this balance here, this, you know, profoundly philosophical and poetic gorilla?
Well, I wanted to, at the same time that Ivan was thinking about, in essence, what it is to be human. I think all animal fantasies at their core are asking questions about who are we as humans? And of course, I wanted to explore the nature of our human responsibility to animals. And by definition, that meant exploring what is a zoo and what is captivity and all the rest of those questions. But at the end of the day, I wanted to be sure that there was plenty of Ivan just living his, what was no doubt, very troubling and confined life. So he thinks a lot about bananas. I had him be an artist, and this was actually based on the fact that the real Ivan enjoyed finger painting. And in fact, I'm told one of his finger paintings, when he was, after he had moved to the zoo, auctioned for something like $5,000. So he was quite the finger painter. And I thought that using art would be a fun and intriguing way to explore what it means to be human and how he communicated with the world. But at the same time, he doesn't have a lot of subject matter, so he ends up painting a lot of what he thinks are bananas. And that was, in many ways, Ivan's life. The real Ivan had this very truncated existence. He did, in fact, have a black and white TV. He had, you know, a steady stream of visitors from the outside, but his life was extremely barren. And I wanted to be sure that as I was talking about Ivan's life, I reflected that. One of the things I have him enjoy doing is rolling up what he calls meatballs, which is basically, you know, rolled up dung. And this is something that primates often will do in a captive setting, just, you know, killing time or perhaps making a statement. And so I wanted to include moments like that, too, to be sure that I was trying to reflect what his life would really have been like.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Catherine Applegate about her novel for children of all ages, The One and Only Ivan.
In fact, I was once the target of one of those meatballs at the Central Park Zoo. I felt something rather wet and slimy that hit me in the neck and looked back, and there was a chimpanzee staring straight at me. So I knew exactly what you were talking about. And I did think of it as a comment. I mean, I took it as a message, actually. And in this book, you have, you know, I'd say a kind of nuanced relationship between the humans that are in the book and Ivan the gorilla. I mean, of course, the humans who captured him in real life and also who have captured other of the characters in the book, you know, are the bad guys. But the people in this book, including his owner, you know, comes across as a, you know, the only word I can say, a nuanced character. Tell us a little bit about Mac.
You know, that was a very deliberate decision because I think so often that reflects the human relationship with animals. We want to care for them, but we don't always care for them the way they should be cared for. We don't know what their needs are. I did not talk to any of the people involved in Ivan's early life, but I am confident, and maybe I'm just being hopeful here, but I really believe that there were moments of genuine love and affection, even as he was being used in a completely inappropriate way. I know that one of his caretakers traveled with Ivan as he was transferred to Zoo Atlanta to make the transition easier. And I think kids are capable of understanding that kind of nuance. They know the world isn't black and white. It's very gray, and they've had no trouble at all understanding Mac's complex relationship with Ivan.
And is it true that Mac actually raised him from infancy until he became, or I mean, I don't know if Mac is his real name, but was he raised as a human until he was too old, too big?
No, Mac is a composite. I started out trying to do this book very journalistically and follow through what actually happened to the real Ivan, and it turned out to be a very, very short book. My editor, Ann Hoppe, said something to the effect of, "Catherine, it's going to be hard to sell a pamphlet." And so I had originally envisioned the book as fictionalized, and I went back to that approach and created many characters, human and animal, surrounded Ivan with these other characters, and it made it possible to have a much richer story. So Mac is a composite, and my understanding is that Ivan was originally raised in a home for the first year of his life and did fascinating and bizarre things like attending baseball games, briefly starred in Daktari, an old TV show, held babies and rode motorcycles and had this very strange existence. But Western lowland gorillas have this annoying habit of growing up, and he ended up weighing well over 400 pounds, and they were facing this silverback in a living room and decided to put him in the mall, and that's how he ended up there. And it was interesting talking to his caretaker at Zoo Atlanta. Jody Corrigan was actually his keeper and had a very intimate and loving relationship with Ivan in the last years of his life. They actually had a memorial service for Ivan when he died, and I flew down to Zoo Atlanta to attend. And she told these wonderful stories about what an intriguing character the real Ivan was, possibly because of those early years being reared with humans. He was very comfortable doing strange things like wearing hats. He had a strange habit of not wanting to get wet, and he would take burlap coffee bags and slide them under his rear end and his hands as he moved across the grass. He was a very intriguing character. Hated men, loved women, had a particular affinity for blondes. So his early years may, in fact, have created, a little bit different personality than you might typically see in a silverback.
Wow. Now, you have also another character who I just, well, you had many, but another human who is this little girl. Tell us about her. And she's an artist also. She's the one who is kind of the, almost you could say, a mentor, artistic mentor to Ivan.
I knew when I wrote the book it was really important to have a human character with whom Ivan could connect. And, of course, it seemed natural that it would be a child. Julia is the name, as it happens, of my daughter, who is 13. And the Julia in the book very much likes to draw. And her father is basically the caretaker, does the sweeping and the cleaning and the drudge work that goes with keeping the mall afloat. And so she is often there in the afternoons drawing. And it seemed like a natural way for this huge primate to make a connection. I had to create a small hole in Ivan's cage in order for them to pass paper back and forth so that they could be exchanging drawings and that sort of thing. But it worked pretty well, I think, and it gave me a way for kids to connect to the story.
Yeah, and she's wonderful. I mean, nobody else understands his art, but she does.
She sees it, yeah, when everyone else is seeing scribbles. She sees more there, and I think that would be very gratifying if you were a frustrated artist. I know.
And it actually, we won't give it away, but it becomes a very critical element in the actual story. Also, there is this, well, we haven't come to Stella yet. We'll do that, but let's first go to, the dog. Tell us about him. And for some reason, I'm blanking on his name. Oh, Bob. Bring us to Bob, the dog.
Bob is based on a dog of mine, a sort of bratty, tiny little rescue dog who, could he talk, would, I'm sure, speak like Bob. Bob is sarcastic, and he's the comedic relief, hopefully, in a book that has some sad moments. He is also Ivan's confidant. He's able to make it in and out of this little enclosure that Ivan is confined within, and sleeps on top of Ivan's stomach, and just generally provides a connection with the outside world. Again, that was a problem with the plotting, because basically you have an imprisoned main character. So Bob was very useful at that level, not to mention being a dear friend and a supporter for Ivan during their darker days. They also enjoy watching TV together. And I'm trying to think. I think Bob preferred dog food commercials. Ivan was a fan of Westerns and human romances. That part was very fun to write. Bob was fun. And I've had kids ask me if there's going to be a sequel with Bob. And I always say no, because the reason Bob works well is because he is working with Ivan. They're a pair.
But one could imagine an adventure story that goes off with Bob, because he is an endearing and feisty character. Also, now Stella is a tragic and wonderful and wise presence in this book.
I've had so many kids ask about Stella, and without talking too much about her storyline, ask why I made the choices I did with her and how it advanced the story, and could I have taken it a different way. And I always tell them, you kind of have to let the story take you where it wants to go. And Stella was so important to Ivan as a mentor and as an example of what happens when you are stuck forever in a place like that. I wanted to think a little bit about circuses and animals in circuses, and without in any way being didactic, hopefully, and show kids the repercussions of having wild animals in that kind of environment. Stella was a former circus elephant, and later on, a younger elephant named Ruby appears. she too had been in a circus briefly. And so they reflect a bit on that as the story unfolds.
Now, did the real Ivan have any contact with other creatures like this? Or was he just really isolated in his cage for 30 years?
There were other animals off and on throughout the years at this mall. And my understanding is, and again, I'm not an expert on the history here, but that quite a long time ago, maybe 30s, a little traveling circus had broken down near this mall. It had a bunch of animals to unload. This mall took in a few of them, and it was great for business. And that's sort of how the whole thing evolved. So over the years, I believe they had a seal or two. They had some monkeys. They had parrots. There was a pet store there. And so he might well have had animals, you know, within sight as he was sitting there in his enclosure.
We're talking with Catherine Applegate about her novel, The One and Only Ivan. It's based on the true story of a gorilla held in captivity in a suburban mall for 30 years. After an outcry, he was eventually brought to the Atlanta Zoo, where he lived another 20 years. Applegate's fictional Ivan tells his story from the first-person perspective.
Now, in the book, there's a protest that happens that frees him. What happened in real life? How did Ivan, well, we can't say really get freed, but he got freed from his solitary confinement in his cell, and he got sent to a pretty progressive zoo, a zoo Atlanta. How did that happen?
It was a long and torturous process. It wasn't, you know, one quick protest. It went on for years. There was a lot of litigation. The mall eventually went bankrupt. But throughout this period, there were several organizations that really were out there advocating day after day after day. And kids played a role, too. I actually got hold of some letters from children. You know, they were writing to the editor and writing to the owner of the mall, writing to various places trying to get Ivan released. And it was so touching because they knew it was wrong and they wanted change. And the change was very slow, but it did happen eventually. And Ivan was put on permanent loan at Zoo Atlanta, which had the largest population of Western lowland gorillas. And as you point out, is a very progressive, and as much as it was still a zoo, it was still an enclosed environment, it was a wonderful improvement over his previous life. And he did eventually interact somewhat with other gorillas, never as successfully as people had hoped. His first encounter with a couple females was almost comically sad. He was chased around the room, and he was just way out of his depths, and they had to separate them. And he was never very happy, apparently, with his long-term female companion. It was like a bad marriage. And Ivan would go outside, and she'd stay in, and she'd come out, and he'd go hide in the enclosure. And there were no progeny, so he did not, unfortunately, breed. But nonetheless, for him, after those many, many years, he had trees and grass and sun and other gorillas. And I'm told he interacted frequently with a younger, with the juveniles, which he was sort of like a, you know, an old uncle, and they would go climb on him and play. And I thought that was a nice image.
That is lovely. What is the lesson, if, you know, we don't like to talk about lessons, but, you know, books for kids do have lessons, and I think this one has a number of profound ones. What are some of those that you would like kids to take away from this book?
Oh, you're right. That's dangerous territory, because, of course, at the end of the day, you want a child to find the lesson that child needs to find in a book, and I just hope it was a fun ride and a good story. But if it helps kids think about the way they interact with the natural world, that would be a wonderful thing. I also liked the message that it's never too late to be what you might have been, that we can change, that we can, in the grimmest of circumstances, find ways to triumph. And often the way to do that is by helping others. That's how Ivan was unwilling to make a change. He was pretty much resigned to his fate until the opportunity to help others someone else came into his life, and that changed him too. So I think it would be wonderful if kids came away with a little bit of that.
And I'd just like to share with you, my granddaughter was moved to tears by this book, and yet also laughed out loud just as I did. I mean, we're only partway through it, so she's barely met Stella, so she's got some treats ahead.
Oh, well, I think that's the highest form of tribute. I had a teacher the other day say she got to one point, and she was reading to her class, and she started sobbing, and one of the children brought her a box of tissues, and another child took over the reading because she simply couldn't. So.
Oh, that's a great story. And it's a wonderful book, The One and Only Ivan. We've been talking with Catherine Applegate. I just want to thank you so much for talking with us here and for writing this delightful and profound and wonderful book.
Oh, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Ivan, Catherine Applegate. Here she is reading an excerpt from The One and Only Ivan.
How I look. I used to be a wild gorilla, and I still look the part. I have a gorilla's shy gaze, a gorilla's sly smile. I wear a snowy saddle of fur, the uniform of a silverback. When the sun warms my back, I cast a gorilla's majestic shadow. In my size, humans see a test of themselves. They hear fighting words on the wind, when all I'm thinking is how the late-day sun reminds me of a ripe nectarine. I'm mightier than any human, 400 pounds of pure power. My body looks made for battle. My arms, outstretched, span taller than the tallest human. My family tree spreads wide as well. I am a great ape, and you are a great ape. And so are chimpanzees and orangutans and bonobos, all of us distant and distrustful cousins. I know this is troubling. I, too, find it hard to believe there is a connection across time and space, linking me to a race of ill-mannered clowns. Chimps. There's no excuse for them.
Catherine Applegate reading from her latest book for children and others, The One and Only Ivan. She's also the author of many books for children and young adults, including The Buffalo Storm, Roscoe Riley Rules, and Animorphs, which she wrote with her husband Michael Grant. Her novel, Home of the Brave, was awarded the 2008 Golden Kite Award for Best Fiction. And we're getting ready to air the fourth in our Writer's Voice special series on the cultural influence of the Connecticut River in Massachusetts. The series is The River Runs Through Us and is partially funded by a grant from Mass Humanities. We could not have continued our series without the support of the many who contributed to our Kickstarter campaign. Among them are Daisy Mathias, who was co-host of Writer's Voice during our early years and has her own poetry show on WMUA 91.1 FM in Amherst, Massachusetts. Writer's Voice webmaster Bill Way. Dr. Jeffrey Scavron, radio man Tony Ernst, poet Patricia Lee Lewis, Writer's Voice guest Les Leopold, author of How to Make $1 Million an Hour, jazz super DJ and producer Glenn Siegel, Timothy Johnson, Nicholas Horton, and Colin Urbina, and last but not least, Rich and Linda Adamek. We had many other contributors, some listed on our website, and others who wish to remain anonymous. We want to send a hearty shout-out to them as well. Go to writersvoice.net to find out more about the River Runs Through Us series and to see our donors. Thank you all. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.